Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Before we commence this episode of Edgy Ideas podcast, I'd like to share two things. One, our Soul at Work event is a live event. It's taking place in northern Spain, close to Barcelona, in a convent, a spiritual center, where we will be joined by a group of international seekers, people who are trying to find a way to bring their soul to work and to think about what it means to bring your soul at work. We have a lovely group. If you can join us, please do contact me for details. Also, we have a diploma in coaching. Our coaching approach thinks about how to create a good society and how to live a good life. So if you're interested in this way of coaching beyond just individual performance, please get in touch and we'll be launching this online program mid-September. On to the podcast. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today, my special guest is Yoko Kuni. Yoko is an award-winning university lecturer, coach and trainer. She works for the Ministry of Defence in the UK. She has advanced degrees in applied linguistics, coaching psychology, and she's a certified coach, hypnotherapist, and a yoga instructor. She's known for integrating language, communication, and cultural insights into higher education, coaching, and cross-cultural training. Her recent award-winning research examines how non-Japanese coaches interpret and apply the Japanese concept of ikigai, challenging the common misconceptions and promoting cultural authenticity. By blending Eastern philosophy with Western psychology, Yoko fosters reflective and values-driven coaching to support meaningful and sustainable change. Yoko, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you doing today?
I feel fantastic, but a little bit nervous, but good. Really, really glad to be here. Thank you very much for your invitation.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And are you're in London, did you say?
I am in London, yes.
So do you want to say something just a bit about your own background, like where you grew up and how you ended up in the UK?
So I'm originally from Japan. I had most of the first educations in Japan. Obviously, I have a Japanese parent. And then I studied psychology, wanted to be a counselor. So psychology always helped me. Personally, every time I have a question about internally, I have a question. Also, my family are all medical, so they're more focused on physical health. But I always wondered about mental health, psychological health. But when I finished my degree, I wanted to be working in a psychology field, but there weren't anything available at the time because of the anything that if you are not normal, you are a crazy person. So if you had stigma attached, mental health, they're all seen as a crazy person or weird. So I couldn't really see any professions that I wanted to do. I actually did that work experience in a mental hospital, but they were all heavily controlled by heavy drugs, strong drugs. Yeah. And they looked like zombie and I felt really uncomfortable. So I went to US because I thought psychology, yes, it's America. So I went to study psychology, but before then I had to study academic English. When I was studying there, I just started feeling like I'm a very sensitive person. And I thought day in, day out, could I listen to everyone's problem when I'm not really discovering myself? And then I encountered linguistics. So then I pursued that way. So then I became Japanese language teacher in higher education. Over the years, I've been teaching for many years, but I did notice many cultural differences. I discovered my own culture, my own identity, the way I think, the value, everything. And also, when I'm actually guiding students into speaking, listening comprehension, anything, I start feeling their psychological safety and also their awareness, self-awareness, all sorts of things I came across. Then, there's a limit to translation. and also limit to how certain culture can be understood by other people that who come from different country, different cultural background. Then I had a few personal challenges. Then I worked on myself, started off yoga training because I've been doing yoga for many years. But I thought lightheartedly, one of my yoga teachers said, I'm running a yoga teacher training. Would you like to do? And I thought, oh, why not? Then I something like suddenly opened up for me. And then I start remembering my original hope, dream, what I wanted to do, which is to get rid of any struggle internally. I also looked at physical health, but really felt the psychological health and also the spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started doing coach training. I received some counseling, but I was a little bit frustrated by, okay, finding out about my past is one thing, but then what do I do? So that's why I wanted to be a coach.
Mm-hmm.
Then I constantly wanted to deepen my knowledge. If I study this, I feel like I'm not enough. That's my theme. I don't feel I'm enough. So I keep studying. So I just completed coaching psychology master's degree, and I did this research that we are going to talk about today.
Yeah, that's quite a journey. And you've got a lot of background there with linguistics and psychology and coaching. There's an awful lot there, which is great. So we're going to talk about Ikigai. So I'm going to let you introduce the idea of Ikigai to imagine the audience doesn't know. I mean, some will know some things, some will know some other things, some will know nothing. So you just start off and tell us what it means, and then we'll go deeper dive into how it's used in the West.
Okay, so Ikigai is very difficult to translate because it's actually in the historical record, we can trace back to 747 BC. This word appeared in some literature, but if you imagine the life at the time and now are totally different. So originally, Ikigai was seen as within the, you know, we were a human were constantly encountering danger or survival, a lack of food, maybe, you know, the natural disasters we have, lots of earthquake, flooding, all sorts of things. So it was originally just simply the moment of, I am lucky to alive, lucky to be here. Mm-hmm. That sort of sensory. But then after the Second World War, we had an economic miracle. So in the 50s, 60s, then suddenly we become richer in a financial term. And then everyone wanted to be successful, wanted to get money, wanted to have house, wanted to have everything, more materialistic needs. But then there's something like a feel empty. Suddenly you stop and thinking, okay, I got all this, but what's going on? I feel empty inside. Then people start looking into this Ikigai. Now, Ikigai, as I say, it's difficult to translate, but linguistically, they are combined words. So Iki, which is a verb stem called Ikiru, which is to live, and Gai is worth doing something. So for example, you can attach Gai after some other word like Hataraki Gai, Oshie Gai, which is like worth doing this effort. So by living, especially in a harsh environment, you live, but you still feel, oh, I feel lucky to be alive. I'm here and I'm like experience this beautiful nature or something like that. But in the 60s, people start contemplating there's something missing. And then there are lots of literature start being published about Ikigai. And until this in Mieko Kamiya, which might appear, she is the psychiatrist. She is the first person to analyze what actually Ikigai is. Until then, because Japan is an island, one nation, one country. We haven't been invaded. So the idea is all we feel. We are all one. You don't have to explain. There are so many words that we feel that we don't really need to define or explain, because that we all know that was the background. But this Mieko Kamiya did try to analyze, but she did have Western influence, quite heavy Western influence. So more she looked at in a more psychological view. So ikigai can be something, it's more like we suddenly feel at certain moment, oh, I'm alive, I feel so energized. Something comes from like a core of our body. That's the kind of sensory things.
Yeah.
So to define, it is difficult. But at the moment, we can talk about two type of ikigai. One is actually the sensory, the feeling of ikigai.
Yeah.
Having to do something, you've been doing something, and then you suddenly feel that this is something that I live for. I'm glad I can do this. Another ikigai is the ikigai target, that actually what you see as ikigai. So for example, you might think that going to gym can be one of your ikigai, or cooking might be your ikigai, or your children might be your ikigai. Your job can be ikigai. So we all have certain type of ikigai.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's traveled. It's been, it's quite ancient. It's lucky to be alive was the first expression. And then when people became wealthier, more materialistic, and tried to think about themselves, you have these two forms. You have the sensory form, the feeling. Maybe in the mornings I go for a swim in the sea, and maybe I feel ikigai when I come out of the sea. I feel refreshed and I feel good.
Yeah.
And then you have ikigai as a goal, as a target, as a direction of travel you want to follow. So you want to follow cooking or gym or cycling or something, yoga, which is going to make you feel good and it's worth doing. Good. Now, you're doing a master's, sorry. Is that at Birkbeck?
Yes.
Yeah. So at Birkbeck University. And you're focusing on a thesis on how ikigai is used by non-Japanese practitioners. So can you say something about that?
Yes. So I kept seeing on the social media about this ikigai Venn diagram. When I first encountered that Venn diagram, I was utterly shocked. And it was, there are lots of likes and forwarding and all sorts of things. And especially amongst coaches, I did notice that there are some coaches that claim to be an ikigai coach, and they were talking about this Venn diagram or talking about purposes. I don't know if you've seen ikigai Venn diagram. It's basically Mark Wynn in 2014, after he listened to one of the TED Talk about Okinawa and longevity, about Japan, he thought that, oh, it would be interesting to make this visible, something visible. So what you have is that what you love, what the world needs, and also what you are good at. And also then final one is something that you get paid for. Now, this last one, which you can be paid for, this section is the one I felt really kicking in my heart.
Yeah.
And that's the same opinion amongst Japanese people. Whenever we see this, no. And especially Venn diagram, this four circle meets in the middle, this sweet spot. Now, the ikigai can be really, as I say, it's a personal. If one is fulfilled, that can be ikigai, because it's up to you to feel. So it doesn't have to be all those four circles and have to have in the middle. But anyway, what's most difficult to take was this about money.
Sure.
And that's the very reason within the economic miracle, Japanese people lost ikigai. So when you're looking at ikigai, you have to also look at when people lost ikigai. What's the situation? How did you lose ikigai? Like a motive to live, almost like you don't want to live. Well, this is a difference between want to die is a more proactive.
Yeah, yeah.
Cutting off your life. But this is more like passive. But I don't have any motivation to live. That's the kind of loss of ikigai.
Yeah.
So basically that Venn diagram to start with, that was really shocking to us. Sure. And also this is like, we are talking about deep culture and this is our soul. You can't really put in a rigid Venn diagram. That also putting into Venn diagram itself or any type of, I don't really care if it's complicated diagram. Diagram, I have a problem with this
Oversimplification. They grab one image and that's it. And they're talking about something much more complex.
Yeah. So the surprisingly that some coaches just believed this Venn diagram to be true. And they saw, oh, this is a good idea. I might use this as a framework. So that's when I thought, what's going on here? That's why I wanted to choose this as a topic, specifically within a coaching environment.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Can we broaden this out a bit? I'm interested. You're from Japan. You've traveled to America. You've lived in the UK. There's quite a lot of usage of Japanese culture in the car. I work in the car industry at the moment, so we use Kaizen and we have these kind of words that, you know, they take some ideas from Japan. And Zen Buddhism was huge in the San Francisco kind of night beat generation and California. What do you think it is about Japan which stimulates this interest and this desire in the West?
You know, what's interesting thing is in Japan, we also take in West, they do this.
Mm-hmm.
And also recently I saw Jewish parents, how they raise children successfully. You know, all sorts of things that we have this kind of book. You know, I think we are all, even we are surrounded by good things. Sometimes we get so used to it become boring. You lose interest and then you want something new, something exciting. So I think that's what's happening. Also that Japan, often people say Japanese is deeply spiritual and mystical and all those things. Yeah, I remember when I first came to UK, I went to listen to this open lecture by British lecturer, academic, talking about Japan. And they kept saying Japanese are deeply spiritual. And I just didn't really understand. My experience is often people talk about Japan without me. They're all kind of talking above me. And I didn't really have opportunity to join in that discussion. So that's why I kind of needed to have my own voice having to experience this. But I think there's something also looking at Japan from outside of Japan. I'm kind of in a between person now that because that I have been living in outside of Japan longer than the time I spent in Japan. There's something about philosophy. It's not all about gaining. It's not all about individual happiness or individual gain. I think in your book as well, by the way, your book, this was my first year textbook and this influenced me a lot. You talked about Western individualism, capitalism, and say, for example, there's one thing I really kind of noticed. In Japan, generally speaking, trains are very accurate. They're on time, they're precise, they're clean. And then when you notice on the platform, these guys are looking at their watch every second and then go, close the door, go. And they don't really care if the old persons with their luggage try to get on the train. They say, sorry, no, we are going now. So that's why trains are accurate. Mm-hmm. Whereas I noticed in UK, the train's always late, but recently it's improved. But I was really quite shocked because that people are allowing these people who are still running, but they're sort of letting it in. Initially, I thought, why do they do that? You know, the rest of the passengers want to go to their destination. They are delaying us. They're nuisance. But then I thought about this. Okay, there's a one coldly every second you're counting and not looking at people because the majority of the passengers are more important in collective society. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas in UK, I thought maybe you can help this one old person try to, you know, struggling with their stairs and luggage. And then there's some sort of humanity. So there I saw this as a whole society, to be able to work precisely, efficiently, you have to almost kill yourself as an individual.
Yeah.
Sacrifice for the sake of the group. That sort of thing I notice. That's why this, you know, sometimes that non-Japanese, more Western organization try to take some Japanese idea. Okay, it's okay for them because they have base of self-care and more individualistic view. But in Japan, it could be unhealthy.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that's very interesting. I mean, I'm working in car industry, and it's one of my critiques is they take ideas from Japan as if their ideas separate from the society. So they take ideas of Kaizen or constant improvement, but they forget that that comes from a collective society where the Japanese car factory gives job for life. You're part of a collective from the very beginning. So that external society collective comes into the factory and people work together in a very different way. Whereas in an American factory or a British factory, this individualism makes it very hard to translate that. And it's not just something you can separate from society. It's part of this kind of wider society. I mean, Japan also, there's something about the aesthetic of Japan, which is very interesting to the West. I mean, Steve Jobs famously kind of, used kind of Zen meditation and ideas about simplicity. We're very fond of looking at Japanese gardens. We think about the aesthetic of sushi, even on a plate, you know, the beauty of the simplicity of the food. And that is a contrast to the West as well. Can you say something about the Japanese aesthetic? I think it's important in some way.
So we have something called kodawari. Kodawari is maybe people really kind of obsessed with a particular thing in a particular way. Also, you know, wabi-sabi, maybe you have heard.
Yeah.
That some imperfection gives some sort of taste or some warmth to us. I think, I mean, I'm not expert. My impression is, you know, we all grew up. It's not just about human or plants, but every single item has a spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to like, I don't usually like bending books or highlighting or drawing things because I feel this book has got a spirit, you know, everything.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The garden, stone, every item has a spirit. So when we are nice to them, they answer to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are talking about, let's say, a cup, teacups, you know, even it's broken, I'm sure that kintsugi is very famous, yeah? In old time, obviously, you can't just break and buy new things. So people repair this, use this. This has got history and also someone's love towards item. So that become almost like a beautiful. So it doesn't really matter if it's not, it doesn't have to be universally beautiful. But there's a something about what this item or someone or something or some event make us feel.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, I think, it's an important thing. So Zen, again, I'm not expert, but this tranquil feeling and also by being where you are here and now, that is also to be able to appreciate. Say, for example, air is something that we breathe and we obviously have one. But it's become like autopiloting. But I always feel like even water. If I didn't have water for 10 days, how delicious it would be when I see this water. So every time I see water, I would say, you know, thank you to the water. And that probably tastes different.
Yeah.
So everything is about, I mean, I'm not saying that every single Japanese people would do that.
Sure,
but
sure.
Say, for example, when I was a child, you know, we all grow up and my feet got bigger. So I was going to get rid of this old shoes. So usually you would just put in a bin. My mom would say, okay, say thank you before we say goodbye, because these shoes protect my feet. all this time.
Mm.
So I tend to do that.
That's interesting. I mean, the collectivism has two sides to it, as you say. So it's there's a tension between individualism and collectivism in what you pay attention to, but also you're bringing a much more holistic understanding of the world around us, the world we create, the world we live in, the natural world, the built world, and the importance of objects and our relationship to them, which is quite different to the West in modern times. In pre-modern times, the West had similar ideas. Pre-modern understanding of the world was it was also filled with spirits. The world was enchanted, and we lost that in modernity. In Japan, it sounds like during the years with materialism, that also was challenged, but still there.
But there's balance needed. Mm-hmm. If you go two of these Japanese way, then we all suffered as well.
Yeah, in the school,
in the workplace, individual well-being is not regarded as important because that you are not going to pull, you know, when everyone's trying to advance, you can't really be behind. So,
I mean, I think it's interesting. You said earlier on about the in Japan, they make the West exotic, and they see things they like from the West, and in the West they make the East exotic and Japan exotic. So Edward Said wrote about this. He wrote about Orientalism from the West, how we kind of project onto the West this kind of exotic other, onto the East, sorry, this exotic other, and vice versa. So perhaps learning from each other. But I think what's important in this conversation is you can't really take Ikigai out of context, can you?
You really need to know where it emerged.
Yeah. And you try and place it into a kind of an individualistic society, which has become increasingly individualistic. It's not just kind of always been individualistic. It's become increasingly so. Some say narcissistic. Christopher Lash wrote about a narcissistic society many years ago. So you take these concepts, you put them into kind of a narcissistic, individualistic society, and they get misunderstood, and they get used in a way, like you say, to earn money or to get paid for, that they get distorted in a way which takes it away from the real meaning.
So the interesting thing was, so I interviewed 13 coaches who self-claim Ikigai coaches. So the most thing that they mentioned was they use Ikigai, this Venn diagram, as a framework for more of a career coaching.
Yeah.
So they're more like to find their work rather than the whole life. So that was quite interesting because it's just the one part of Ikigai. But if whole Ikigai is all about profession, what if you lose that job? What if something goes wrong and if you don't like your work anymore? There are all sorts of things happens. So you have to think about, you know, Ikigai is also temporary. It's not forever. You may find one Ikigai you think that, oh yes, this is my Ikigai. But then you might lose it or you might not be interested in it anymore. Then you constantly have to find next one. Or some people can live without Ikigai, which is the case. Say, for example, I asked myself, what's my Ikigai? I can't really give you an answer because that if you are living in a lukewarm, comfortable situation, you don't really need to look into Ikigai.
Mm.
Ikigai somehow, most of the research or most of the time that when Japanese people talk about their Ikigai, tend to be older people. So older people, they're retired and they can kind of see themselves as in maybe their health is deteriorating, their mobility is limited. Then they start thinking, or maybe they have terminal illness, or maybe you lost loved one. Mm. That sort of extremely sad situation, challenging situation, people start thinking, what's my Ikigai? Then people start searching for Ikigai. But say, for example, if you are living, it's okay, not much problem, just a little bit of up and down. If you have that sort of life, you don't really actively seek Ikigai, to be honest.
Yeah.
So if I ask my Japanese surrounding, they all, if I say, what's your ikigai? What's the big deal? Sometimes ikigai sounds a little bit too heavy on us because ikigai is actually worth living. You're not just talking about worth doing this project. You're talking about whole life. So it's quite heavy.
Yeah, which is the central point of this podcast is interesting. I mean, I ask people at the end of the podcast, and I'm going to ask you now at the end of the podcast. Really, I guess the question is, what is your ikigai? Because my question to people is, what does it mean to live a good life? And what does it mean to create a good society? Now, I ask both questions because often people get stuck on the first. What does it mean to live a good life? And it's our belief that you can't really live a good life unless you're part of a collective, unless you think about the bigger society. So we connect the two. So how does that make sense to you? If I ask you, what does it mean to live a good life and create a good society? What thoughts do you have, having studied ikigai for a long time?
Yeah. So ikigai has two sides to it. One is highly personal. So if I think about my personal thing, how, you know, ikigai would help my life living good life, which is to start with health, physical health, mental health, spiritual health. So that's the first thing, or health in any healthy relationship with work or anything. That healthy is, for me, it's very important. You can go into lots of detail, but that's the general word for me. That's my personal thing. But also psychology is, in a way, for me, it helped me to be healthy, maintaining my well-being. So I want to pursue my interest or research within psychological framework or field. And also really, I really, really feel, especially I living in this Western country and looking back Japan and also how Japan is changing. Really, we can't be just pursuing our own wants and needs. We have to sometimes sacrifice for the sake of environment, for the sake of other people. Because that when you are, let's say, maybe you want to do this first, but let other people go first, then they would say thank you and they create a nice feeling.
Mm-hmm.
By being receiving thank you, I feel good about doing that because of that something that in the air, you have some like a friendly, warm feeling to it. So same as environment. Okay, I want to buy this, but this has got plastic container. Should I not buy this? All sorts of things I do tend to think because we have to really long-term think about to be able for individual to living in a nice environment, people, whether people or building or other environment, we have to really look after those things.
Sure, sure.
So I think it's like a one is individual thing, but you cannot really disconnect with the surroundings. That's how I feel.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're aligned. So listen, Yoko, thank you very, very much for your sharing your wisdom and your thoughts. I'm sure the audience will really enjoy this and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.